Secrets Measure, the case of the case of the butchers. So what I really wanted, and this goes directly to the point we were just discussing that Rajatha made yesterday, I really wanted the bold line where he says,
Which bold line are you reading?
First page, Vigorous Moshe. Right? So he says, there are two kinds of issues. There are pure financial issues, and then there's what he calls Yorid Lumnasa Mahapi Chachara, which are in Yanei Isur. So Yanei Isur, so first of all, that enables the conversation about not just so much prior restraint, which is, right, which, but the legitimate, it compels you to ask the question, is what I am doing correct, as opposed to, can somebody stop me from what I'm doing? Now we saw the language of Isur in one of the, yes?
With the language of Isur, are you taking it as what I'm doing is correct morally, or is it actionable? Because me and Sam, when we saw that there's a differentiation between Isur and Pauline,
yes,
as one being just you shouldn't do this morally, and this is one having actionable.
So again, the word morally is a problematic word. I would say there are situations that give rise to legal redress, and actions that don't necessarily give rise to legal redress. And Isurim, as opposed to polymamish, means that there is not necessarily an action for legal redress, right? But then with distinction between whether it's morally or halachically asur, right? That's already much more complicated.
Okay.
Now we saw the language of asur in your question set. No question in the Ravan, because the Ravan in talking about the teku, right? So one of the tzadim was maybe it's a teku de isura as opposed to a teku de mamona. Right, so I wanted to establish that for Rav Moshe, not just Yorid Lumnasa, but also Mahapik Bicharara, that he takes Nikrara Shah as meaning that this is an issue of Isur, and that being the case, I think that raises both those questions. One is that you have a chiv to ask, am I allowed to do this, and not wait for the other person to sue you, and B, that it opens the possibility of reversing the teiku. Okay, shuva number two. Which is Rav Moshe's reaction to overpriced funerals, which is still a very live issue. And grave.
No.
You like really are the only allowed one more of the whole shaker, so use it wisely.
No more humor. The rest of the shaker shall just be funereal. Any case. Yes.
I'm sorry, this is not Gallows humor. Going back to the first question about Yanei Isur, why doesn't he, how does Rav Moshe understand why the Gemara said Nikra Rasha and not to say Asur?
He thinks Nikra Rasha is worse than Asur. There are Isurim you can do without being called a Rasha. This is a serious enough Isur that you're get called a Rasha.
What did Rav Moshe say? That, like, he loses his case?
So I don't know whether he goes that far, right? We have a whole, right? That was our whole first topic, that there's tons of stuff.
I forgot week one.
You gotta go back. Everything has to be held in mind. Yes, Chaim?
Yeah, we were wondering whether the new Shaykhet knew that he was taking over for some other.
Oh, in that case, Rav Moshe is clear that he thinks it was just, well, the new Shaykhet knew, I don't know. Right, but Rav Moshe thinks the other people, right? This was a, but what happened here is Lechora, Rav Moshe certainly suspects this, is they knew that he held that people have a chazaka on their job. So in order to fire somebody without being taken to Besdin, they pretended to close the business and then reopened it with another case of Rav Moshe, which is explicitly like this. And so as a way of, in the same way that many businesses do, as a way of depriving people of seniority rights. Right? They pretended to close the business and then fire all the workers. And then open a new business, which was the same business. They never gave up the lease on their place, right? They never gave up their customers. In the same way that the stores will declare going out of business sales, and right, and sell the, right, at the last minute they'll sell it to their brother for a dollar, and the new store will open and go out of business 6 months later. Yes.
What I meant to ask was that he's treating Mahapik Bacharara as like something that you can undo.
That you can, yeah. What do you mean by undo?
The person he hired is the one who's actually being laid off from the Ani, and basically, like, if you want to fire him, you have to hold that even if it was done by accident?
Could be. I don't know. I suspect when you came to Bezer, Rav Moshe thinks the cause of action is not against the new shochet, but against the owners who hired the new shochet. Right? He'll think that the other shochet can sue not the new shochet, but the owners for back wages and reinstatement. I think that's what he'll do. What he'll say.
Well, what about the new shochet?
So the new shochet, he'll say that sure the old shochet can sue the new shochet for his back wages. But then the new shochet can sue the balabatim because he did services for them without compensation. So immediately you might as well just go straight. I don't think he's going to end up depriving the new shochet of his wages, particularly if it was accidental. I think he's going to end up saying the money has to come from the owners because the owners engaged in a fraud. And they're responsible. I think that's what he's going to say. I think. Yes, Tova?
Asking a historical question.
Yes.
Like, does this matter? Does this matter in the sense of what is the Moshe's relationship to the legal recourse, in secular court of the individuals?
None. The Moshe is assuming that he has power, that people will come to him.
No. But is he assuming that there's no other recourse without him?
Yeah. What recourse could there be? They have no right. There's no tenure. There's no lifetime contract. What recourse would they have?
No, you can sue for deceitful termination of a contract. This is presumably four people have a contract and two people terminate it.
Only if you had a right to continue.
Do we assume that he's posturing this way because there is no civil legal recourse?
No, I think he assumes you have to go to Beit Din without. Right? Why would you go to civil court? You have a Beit Din.
So that's my question. Is in regards to the question we've been thinking about, or Rabbi Kaplan's been thinking about about the relationship with Moshe and Mishpat, right? Does a different motion think that it was important to construct a cogent form of monetary halacha to act as an alternative?
That is a fair question. I don't know that Rav Moshe is as bothered or as aware. He may live in more in a Rav Jachter's world, and he where the people in his community came to him. He may not have seen Chosh and Mishpat as quite as defunct. And he may not have been interested in having it have a macroeconomic impact.
There's no way that's true.
Why?
What? Because when it comes to the case of the shuls, right?
Yeah.
He clearly is trying to make, this is like policy for everybody.
Yes, for Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's trying to set, right, Rav Moshe, so I don't know of any extended treatment of this. I think that Rav Moshe has very strong economic opinions and that they need to be worked out really seriously. I mean, the general thing I want to say is Rav Moshe's constituency is working class. And so he writes tshuvot that generally that address the interests of the working class. And somewhere in the 1970s or so, Orthodoxy shifts from being a working class society to being a managerial class society. And particularly modern Orthodoxy has almost no one, right, at least doesn't recognize people working classes in this community, which is a real problem. And so our questions are all the managerial class, working class, managerial upper class type questions. And it's not a question, it's not a bias or a, it's just he got asked questions by working class people or by employers who were employing working class people. And people like me will get asked questions by doctors and lawyers and accountants and things like that. Or those are the people asked the shilohs, so your perspective is shaped by what kind of questions you're asked. So Rav Moshe has very, very strong positions about the way an economy should run. And I think that they are less capitalist in a certain way. For example, he assumes that all workers have tenure. He assumes that it should always take, that certainly he assumes all Klei Kodesh that cannot be fired out of Beit Din.
He assumes that all workers have tenure, or he assumes all workers have the right to severance pay because the government is failing?
All workers have tenure. All workers have tenure. Therefore, if you are fired, even for cause, as long as it's not for
flagrant violation.
Yes, then you get Chodesh Hoshana. Right? He has an enormous social welfare safety net.
What is that? Maybe I didn't understand. This is Aj. Does that mean that they get a full year of the one quarter of the?
No, what he's saying is that if, but in his world, workers have no protection if a business goes out of business. Right? It's part of the weakness of Chodesh Lashana, right? It's not a funded mandate.
Yeah.
So he says, so we need some kind of measure to decide if this company has really gone out of business or if it's a fraud.
Okay.
So his answer is, if they're back in business inside a year, it's a fraud. It's the same business.
And then they have the right to be fully reinstated.
And then all employees have the right to be fully reinstated.
Okay, so I guess, like, do we think, or does Rabbi Copper think that this, that Rav Moshe's tshuva would be different if he was addressing an individual or a community which had was seriously considering civil law as not a viable alternative? As, like, when we talk about Choshen Mishpat, what we're saying is, we need to provide something that is a, like, we are operating under the assumption that most people are dealing with these things in secular courts.
Yes, I don't know the, I don't know what Rav Moshe would have, may have. This is Tav Shin Chav, right? So we're around 1960, right?
Yeah.
I don't know how Rav Moshe would have. I don't know how Moshe would have reacted to. I don't know if he had the same issues. I really don't know. I do think that he has very strongly held economic positions. I do think that if he were aware of better options in Chodesh Lashana that were, or as he became aware of better options in Chodesh Lashana, I like to think he would have shifted to things that were better for workers. You know, shifted to mandates that were fundable as opposed to unfunded mandates, to things that protected you regardless, right? But I think the Chodesh Lashana was his tool, and he used it to try and create that. I think tenure was his tool, right? Would he have been flexible, recognizing that there were other ways to create worker protection that might have better, greater economic advantages and be better for workers? Sure, but I can't prove that.
Or. Yeah, Jen and I were talking about how so many of the stuff in here just seems so totally alien to our like economic.
Yes, so that I think there's a lot of work needed. Like, you know, this is a doctorate, not a master's, to put together the economic theory of Moshe Feinstein, and to what extent it's rooted in his experiences in Europe. I think that, to the best of my knowledge, there is no scholarly, intellectual biography of Moshe Feinstein at all. Like, no one's traced, you know, he has certain positions which you can tell he's very happy, that that he's really proud of, because he quotes them repeatedly, and he quotes them as the Chiddush that I said in 1920 and such forth. But for example, right, almost everybody, you know, myself included, has read, right, maybe even if you've read, you know, tremendous swaths of Igros Moshe, but not that many people have read through Dibros Moshe, which is really, you know, it may very well be that we're in the same thing.
Is it published before? Like, what's...
Some volumes of Dibros Moshe are out during his lifetime, more published posthumously.
Wait, what is it?
Dibros Moshe is Hishurim. And that's probably, you know, the same way as Dr. Soloveitchik argues about the Ravid. So probably that's really where the center of his thought is. And the Truvot are just things that he has to write, because people make him write them, because the case comes up. But because the Truvot are the things that, right, that he don't have to prepare for to read. And the Chavot address, right, and they're shorter. So everyone reads this.
And understandable.
And they're, yeah, it's much, much, much easier. Dibros Moshe is, you know, he has to prepare for Shir. Right? And he has to be in Shir every day. And every once in a while, he quotes something, so you can go look, and you see that he has a long thing about American patriotism. Right? And every once in a while, he'll tell you in his Chavot, and here you can look at this Chiddush that I said all along. But I think this is just one of the many, many areas where there should be room for really serious scholarly study of, you know, probably the most important rabbinic figure of the 20th century in the West, for sure. But it has just hasn't been done yet. You know, at the very beginning, right, so people try and say, oh, maybe Rav Moshe changed his mind about this. But, you know, in academic biographies, we'd expect him to, like, there's just read this marvelous book about how some Supreme Court, how Oliver Wendell Holmes changed his mind about free speech. Right, and, you know, and a dialogue, and they reconstructs all the conversations he had with which friends, and the letters back and forth, and that was really fun to see. Nobody, to my knowledge, has done that for Rav Moshe.
Which book was that?
I don't remember the name.
Was it Scorpions?
I don't think so. I don't know. So I think that there's a lot to do about that. You know, all I can say is my impression is Rav Moshe has very strong opinions about. About workers in general, and about economic class, and that he has legal mechanisms to try and accomplish these things. But I don't have a comprehensive theory. But I think the material's all there.
I mean, no, I have like four Chuvot here. Sorry, like six.
That's a lot. No, but you can read through all this Chuvot. You know, you have to, I mean, someone will have to read through all the Chuvot in probably through all of Igros Moshe, at least skimming to make sure that you're not missing anything, although it's indexed now. And then you have to read through Igros Moshe consecutively, above Metzia and all the relevance of Geut, and that's why it's a doctorate. That should be a fine doctorate, yes.
Was it Moshe's makar for Kod Lashoshana?
Pardon?
What is it Moshe pull out? What's the precedent for Kod Lashoshana?
There
is
his
own thing.
There isn't one much. There isn't much of one.
Is that Shabbat?
Don't know. Decide for yourself. Separate share.
You can't make up something and
just, you can't make up something. You have to claim it's a minhag.
Don't make it into a minhag.
Or you declare it a minhag. Yeah. That's the whole question, right? So Rav Belsky essentially says that, but that Rav Moshe created the minhag. But he also thinks that he also claims that Rav Moshe only cares about Klei Kodesh. Rav Moshe really tried to create it for all workers, but he only had influence on Torah Masorah, so Torah Masorah officially has it. And if you read the book Kodesh Lashana, you'll see it's really interesting to see that the reports of Rav Moshe's position from people who knew him are all about everybody, but the psakim from people who don't know him are all about Kodesh Lashana. All about Klei Kodesh. That's all that caught on. And part that's because America developed all sorts of other protections for workers. So the need to put in Kodesh Lashana when you have pension plans and you have, right, all those are replaced. Now, what Rav Moshe would have done had someone told him that day schools are the only people who don't pay unemployment insurance, I have no idea. I find it just weird that that just grew up without anybody noticing. That religious institutions exempt from unemployment insurance. It just flips me out. Okay. So now, in the second Shiva Igros Moshe, in the funeral home case, Rav Moshe says that in such a case, don't worry about Hasagas Gvul. Now, why don't we worry about Hasagas Gvul? So he doesn't say don't worry about Hasagas Gvul because, quoting the Rimigasha cited by the Ramban school, and say, well, here's a great discount for the Lochim, so we don't care about Hasagas Gvul. He says they're thieves. Right? They're thieves. And he says, right now what is his remedy? His remedy is that Beit Din, not that Beit Din should permit competition, right? Beit Din should set up competitors. Right? Reach out to the non-Jews and set them up as a, right, set of competitors, or that language, right? Yes, Ramakla.
It sounded sort of like the Ramban language when
yes.
He said that if you don't have the means to
yes.
Do it,
yes, exactly right. I think that this is almost, right, this is a paraphrase of the notion of the Ramban. Beit Din gets to set prices, and the prices it sets has to be fair for the mocher and the lokeach, and if the mocher refuses to go down, so then either you set up an internal competitor, right, or you allow competitors. Just Rav Moshe's language is really, really strong, which we saw, right? You know, we saw unjust rewards. Rav Moshe says that essentially, Rav Moshe says charging monopoly prices on a necessity is theft, which is really strong language. I figured out what his parameters for that are. Yes, Eli.
You said nine Jewish.
Yeah, that's what he's talking about, Rav Moshe here. Right? Do you have to go to a
I didn't catch that, so I just
want to
make
sure. Yeah, no, this is the Chiddush, right? Moshe is willing to say...
I don't think the Ramban would have said you can accept a non-Jew to be a...
That is a fair question, whether Ramban would have said even go to non-Jews. I don't know. But I think, you know, this is a... Now, Rav Moshe is right that there is a long history, right? He has a beautiful, you know, doesn't need me to tell you, right? There's a beautiful history of people seeing funerals as moments of vulnerability when people can overcharge, and this is still an issue not just in the Jewish community but the African American community.
There's a famous quote from Sober Brother, right?
Could be. I think there are many tshuvos about that. I think this has gone on throughout history. And that's the whole question of how you balance. It's not information asymmetry. It's vulnerability. It's emotional vulnerability.
Well, it's an elastic demand.
Fred?
It's an elastic demand. It's not about, like, vulnerability, right? It's that literally people need.
But you could, right?
No,
but there,
no, no, no.
But
it's psychological.
But if there are two funeral homes, right? You could, people aren't going to comparison shop. That might, right? Is the issue, right? You're there in a conversation with the funeral director, and you're not in the mood to bargain.
I see.
He says, wouldn't you want to buy this?
Yeah, don't you want to buy the extra...
The mahogany coffin with the gold.
Right, don't you think your father...
This is our most modestly dressed father.
Yes.
Or sometimes, I'll give you options. You can have the $50,000, the $10,000 one, or the $5,000 one.
Right. Don't you think that your father would have preferred...
Right.
You always have to be careful about that. It's like one thing that had a deep impression on the invaded ones where we were getting to a moment of do the right thing. And will the parties compromise? And so I turned to one of the litigants and I said, don't you think that your father would have wanted you? And they said, no. My father would have wanted me to take him for everything he had. That's who my father was. But nonetheless. So we have to be careful. I'm not fully, I assume funeral directors are better at this than I am.
So what do we think that this is like generalizable to industries which there is a monopoly and it is a necessity, but you don't have the same emotional vulnerability?
I don't know. All I know is Rav Moshe says that there is a circumstance in which people charge a price in which both parties are fully agree, and there is no fraud in the sense that you're not providing what you say you're providing. And nonetheless, he considers it theft to the point where he thinks that it is incumbent upon Beit Din to find a non-Jew to compete at lower prices.
I don't think it's emotional vulnerability, because he brings up the Eichli Chayim Nefesh. So the assumption is that it's the necessity that's the...
Right, but he also says, right, Peter, that Hotzatza meis kasher lekrov v'yoser v'misasso shemim v'spaishin, right, shemim v'spaishin aniyim, right, he's the right people. People get embarrassed, right, if you funerals are important displays of wealth and... of wealth and honor, and so you feel ashamed if your parent. That's why Rabbi Gamliel said it's the kind of everyone got buried in white, because otherwise people would mortgage their fortunes. The same way now we don't do it for funerals; we do it for weddings.
Wait, so is this the equivalent of? Like, I'm confused about this. Like,
weddings, people pay fortunes for weddings and bar mitzvahs, right? To keep up with the Joneses.
So do you think that people are charging too much money for a good that everybody needs? You have two ways of controlling it, right? You can either introduce a competition,
uh-huh.
or you could set a cap on how much people are allowed to spend.
You can create sumptuary laws.
So, like, the question is he...
He doesn't have the option of creating a sumptuary laws, because the issue is... Because, first of all... He doesn't have that power in a broader community, and secondly, he's dealing with a case where there's a monopoly. So if you set the sumptuary laws, you're going to have to stare them down and actually, have somebody sitting in a funeral home and saying, "Well, I'm sorry, my rabbi said I can't pay more than $1,000."
But that's how weddings work, though, right? They instituted the idea of a takana wedding, I guess a takana wedding, and then once they said a takana wedding,
you have to find a caterer willing to.
But it's the same pressure, the same emotional pressure.
Yes. Weddings, you have lots more time.
You do, but if the Joneses are spending, having a five-day
But you have
span,
time. Funerals, you don't have time.
Okay, I don't know if I understand the limitations of this case.
People are, somebody dies, and there's only one Jewish funeral home in town, and they come and they say, do you want the $50,000 funeral or the $75,000 funeral?
But he doesn't come and he doesn't tell the funeral home that you are being over halakha.
Because they're not asking.
Or does he just not believe that they're being over halakha, Are they being over any sort? Or is it just that this is like...
They're theft. They're thieves.
Right, so then, like...
If they wrote in the question, he would say, you're being thieves. But he's assuming, right, this rabbi who's writing to him has already tried his best to talk them into it.
Okay.
And they say, we're Shomer Shabbos. You should all buy from us. And he says, you're Shomer Shabbos, but you're thieves. I'm going to go get a non-Jewish funeral home. And they
why
say, tell him...
Why not another
Because there are no other Jewish funeral homes in town.
But if you're going to be... Oh, you're saying find another funeral home that's already in business
yeah.
that can cater to...
That's right.
Context, this is Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where Rabbi Twersky lives, so it's not a very big Jewish community.
Yeah, there probably isn't enough business, and it's probably, to set up a competitor, which, again, will probably drive him out of business, right, and there'll be, and somebody's going to lose money, right, so it's a high-risk activity, because there aren't going to end up being two Jewish funeral homes in town.
But he can just lower his prices, right? That's the point.
He could lower his prices. And in Hanami, if they get a non-Jew to compete, and the Jewish funeral lowers his prices, the non-Jew will leave the business. But he's assuming existing funeral homes, they won't lose anything. He's just setting up a non-Jew as a potential competitor.
At that point, do you have to worry, then does the non-Jew get any kind of protective status? Then,
That's a fair question. Do you owe him, or does he have an opportunity? Those are all fair questions. A question here in town, right, is trying to sustain lower priced caterers. That's
a chubby chickpea.
Yes. Right. That's a big challenge here, right? Trying to sustain lower priced caterers under the same profit margin. So hashkacha, right? The hashkacha cost for lower right? For lower price caterers, the same as higher price caterers.
Yeah.
So they're right. So it's very hard for them to be competitive, and figuring out how we as a vod try to handle that, because our costs don't change, right? Their hashgacha costs are the same as our hashgacha costs. So how it is that you can sustain a lower price caterer in the market is a very hard thing. So far, not terribly successful. Yes, Chaim.
Yeah.
And it's from Achla.
So would Rav Moshe hold a tenure for non-Jewish funeral home?
I don't know. I don't know if he holds about non-Jews. I don't. I think that would be a Darkei Shalom issue. I think. I don't think he'd hold it an inherent right. I think he'd hold it's a Darkei Shalom issue. Okay. Yes, from Achla.
Like, this tshuva is very, very, very hard to generalize from in any way whatsoever, because you don't know if it's about Jewish significant things, or about emotionally significant things, or about necessities, or about significant overcharging, or about funerals just specifically, or about.
No, all you know is what you can say is that Moshe believes that there are circumstances under which you charge a mutually agreed price for a mutually recognized service, in which the contract is. By all the normal canons of law, the contract is perfectly free, and nonetheless, he calls it theft. Right? There's no deception, there's no coercion, there's just the pressure of circumstances. Right? At the moment, he can say, now how far he's going to go to call that theft? He doesn't tell you what the profit margin is. Right? He doesn't tell you what would be considered a legitimate profit margin and an illegitimate profit margin. He doesn't tell you what degree of emotional pressure is necessary. Right? He doesn't.
But is it useful in any way whatsoever?
Yes, because it tells you that principle. Now, so if you are confronted by such a circumstance in which you feel that is the case, you can say, look, I can't tell you Rav Moshe would have said that about this case, or if you want to say that you say what Rav Moshe said about this case, Kal Vachomer would say about this case, and you find the factor that your case is even more egregious. But if somebody were to come and tell you, no, it's a freely agreed contract with no fraud, under what circumstances can you call that theft? You can say Rav Moshe called it theft. And then you can decide what the what it is that whatever the product is that you think is overpriced. For me, it's I think Chalav Yisrael milk was an excellent model in that way.
Doesn't think you have to buy Chalav Yisrael milk. That's a bad example.
No, but I get the quote. This is my favorite Rabbi Willick psak. That Rabbi Willick told us that the Chalav Yisrael prices were exorbitant. And that was, and that the burden of Chalav Yisrael prices, this is 20 years ago, it's 31 years ago, that Chalav Yisrael prices were exorbitant. And he was telling this about something that happened several years earlier. So we're probably, but he was telling us this 31 years ago in Shir about something that probably happened 7 years earlier, that Chalav Yisrael was a cartel, and the prices were double that of regular milk, and the burden of that was falling on the poorer yeshivot and Haredi families, and that possibly the cartel was being sustained by illegitimate means. That's a separate question, but because I think it was pretty clear that other people who tried to enter into the market and compete were intimidated out of it by coercion, and then a New Jersey dairy called Goldman's, which was not Jewish, ironically. By Dan Goldman, has decided that to improve its shelf space, it would launch a Chalav Yisrael line, and that it would sell it for the same price as its regular milk. And Goldman's was too big to be intimidated out because it didn't live in the Jewish community. And Rabbi Willick got up in Shul and Paskin that even though he Paskin like Rav Moshe that there was no need to buy what is colloquially known as Chalav Yisrael. My wife gets very upset because the whole point is of course you have to buy Chalav Yisrael. The question is whether everything is Chalav Yisrael or not. Rabbi Willick got up and said everybody had to buy Goldman's. Until the cartel was broken.
Wow. Is that written anywhere?
Did it work?
Yeah.
Is that anywhere?
I don't know. Oh. I don't know. That to me is like one of the models of psak for like the things that the things like that would be a psak. I would be proud of having. I would be proud of having issued. And the cholesterol prices dropped quite dramatically. Crept back up a little bit since.
Still
I think.
Twice as much as regular milk.
I think it crept back up because there is no longer a non-Jewish competitor, and it took time. There were for a while. There were competing. Right after that, I think there were some competing. This year, New Square opened up as a different distributor, and that's right.
Golden Flow.
Pardon?
Golden Flow is now the New Square.
Golden Flow was Golden Flow. Golden Flow. Golden Flow. Golden Flow was right. They were J&J and Golden Flow were owned by the same people, and then New Square opened up as a competitor, and I don't know what the story is now.
I would say the quality is so milk, is the quality so bad? That, like,
okay, we're not going to go there. It's not the milkness, it's more the shipping anyway, but
yes.
And the storage. Any case, that is a separate, but that is my model. That is my model of what a really economically aware and socially responsible PSOC.
So what do you think is the exciting bit about this?
I said again, because he says that you can have a freely arrived at contract with no fraud, which he considers, right, where he considers the result to be theft, and that Beit Din not only has an obligation, not only has the right, not only is there no tine of Hasagas Gvul against such people, you have an obligation to break the monopoly.
Okay.
Even if that means going outside the Jewish community. That's pretty wild. Okay.
But why is the Chiva on Beit Din to break up the monopoly?
Because Rav Moshe thinks that's what Beit Din's job is, to order a society, because he has a Ramban view of the world. Beit Din runs the, right? Rabbanim and Beit Din run the world. We have real achrayut, and if we don't exercise it, it's our fault. And it's a very different world than an assumption in which, you know, Beit Din rabbis have nothing to do except when people ask them questions. Yes?
What about in a case where there's not one funeral home, let's say, that has the monopoly, but multiple funeral homes that, whether implicitly or explicitly...
So I think if they're a cartel, they're a monopoly, right? And he'll treat it the same way. I don't think he cares if it's one person.
Even if it's not, a cartel is one thing. Like, explicitly threatening people who try to break up the monopoly is one thing. But like, just
and they all charge the same.
That's what Jewish funerals cost.
So I think Rav Moshe would say that the job of the rabbi is to call them in and say, "We need a lower price competitor," and they'll say, "This is what it costs." And you say, "Then," and if he thinks that the price is still exorbitant, then their prices are suspiciously similar.
Mm-hmm.
Then he would, right? He would say, "Look, I'm going to go look for a competitor." And if it turns out that there's no, right, that he can't get a competitor for a lower price, and he was wrong. Right, that's the job of the Beit Din, is to go find out if you can do that. Now they, of course, are going to claim that the price the non-Jewish competitor is suing is actually predatory pricing,
right.
And that's why Beit Din has to have serious economic analysis.
Hard to claim that if they're charging similar prices to their.
Obviously, they're going to claim that the price of the Jewish rituals is what
is more expensive,
right? Obviously, they're going to claim that.
What are Muslim burial practices?
I have the faintest idea.
Very similar.
It's pretty similar, right?
Yeah.
So, like, if you could.
Yeah, right, and you can try setting up a volunteer organization that does the same thing. Right, some volunteer organization that does, this is what Rabbi Aaron Leibowitz is trying to do in Yerushalayim, right? That's all the court cases about, where he's trying to set up volunteer private hashkachot to compete with the Rabbanut.
Right. But I guess, is there any aspect of predatory? Maybe what he's saying is it doesn't matter if you're doing predatory pricing at that point.
If it's good for the consumer, maybe. I don't know what he would do, right? I don't know what he would do if the non-Jewish people came in and said, "You know what, Rabbi, we'll come in and we'll charge a fifth of what they're doing, because once they're out of business, we can charge the same price as they were." I don't think he'd good bit.
No.
You try.
Okay, so that's
right. So I think he wouldn't do that either.
But there's other types of predatory pricing, right?
Well, predatory pricing is predatory pricing means that you are not charging what you would ordinarily charge if you were engaged in the business. You're doing it for some other purpose, which is usually in the hopes that you will have fewer competitors in the long run.
Right.
Right? Sometimes it's just because you're being nasty, but the non-Jewish funeral home has no reason to be nasty. They just want, right? They just want to drive the Jewish funeral home out of business. So I think probably Rav Moshe wouldn't allow that either. I think. Yeah, whether it would work or not, so this is the same problem as any regulatory scheme. Right? You know, it assumes that the regulators are competent and have time. And it's very rare that rabbis are either competent or have time to do such things. Right? So it runs into the same problem as all government regulation.
Well, also, hopefully, it doesn't run into the other problem of
regulatory capture. A regulatory capture. So that's also right. If you have enough rabbis regulating funeral home prices, eventually there will be a board of rabbis regulating funeral home practices, and eventually the funeral home directors will donate to that board of rabbis, and we'll have the conference of rabbis who regulate funeral home practices, which will just happen to be in Hawaii, right? Known as the hub of Jewish funeral home. I still get it, but the International Conference of Chairman of Electrical Engineering Departments takes place in Hawaii every year, because that obviously is the place most convenient to all the universities. So my father had to go to Hawaii every year. Probably they looked at the map and they said, let's see where the place which is closest to all the major universities in the world that they came up with. Oahu, right? That's where it has to be.
We should really move on. But was there not a market solution? Is this the market solution? Like, what's the? Is he like?
There's a market solution is to let the non-Jews be in business. The market solution to most overpricing issues in the Jewish community is to and quality issues is to try and find some way to make it economically possible for either the product to compete for the non-Jewish market or for non-Jewish suppliers to produce for the Jewish market. Right, that's the way in which you create competition, in which you create economy of scale.
Right.
So restaurant quality depends on being able to reach out into the non-Jewish market very often, and prices depend on there being a non-Jewish supplier who uses the same economies of scale. That's always the strategy to solve quality and price issues in the Jewish community is always going to be bringing in the non-Jewish. That has a cost because you lose your economic independence, lose your economic autonomy of your community. Right, and someday you wake up and discover, oh my goodness, here we are. The entire Orthodox Jewish community is dependent, is dependent on some group of evangelicals somewhere for their entire supply of etrogim. Right, and if they suddenly decide that that it's not in their interest to provide etrogim this year, we're all going to be back to the times of Gemara, passing the one etrog all around. I don't know what old controls etrogim. That's what happens, right? When you outsource for economic advantage, right? You become dependent on outside suppliers, and so there's an interest in the. Right, let's forget us. Right? What if the Catholic Church, what if Jews suddenly decided they wouldn't provide communion wafers?
Yeah.
Right? Are there any non-Jewish Jewish factories in the country that are capable of producing communion wafers? who knows, right? They're wholly dependent on us.
It's Manischewitz matzo.
Holy dependent.
It's not Manischewitz, it's Straits.
Yeah, I'm wondering, though, are you saying that Moshe would say that there's one kosher food business in the town and they're ridiculously overpriced? The hashgacha should go to non-kosher food places and give them
email. You should try and talk. If there's only one restaurant, I don't know if he thinks a restaurant is a necessity, but let's suppose if there's only one Sfarim store in town.
Grocery.
Right. And he thinks that they're charging exorbitant prices. Now again, what does exorbitant prices mean? Like, what happens if you have, the store in Washington Heights? Store in Washington Heights charged much higher than the Jewish store. You don't know what he would do if he said that this store charges exorbitant prices, but it's the only way it charges exorbitant prices because for economy of scale reasons, the only way that it is viable as a standalone business is if it charges much higher prices. I don't think he would say that's theft, right? If you run the Chalav Yisrael milk store in Woodburn. So you're spending lots and lots of time, and you're only going to get 20 customers, 30 customers a day. So you're going to have to charge twice as much for milk to make a reasonable income. I don't think that's the same thing. Funeral homes are doing okay. People keep dying.
Trust me. So is Mountain Foods in Woodburn.
I don't know. I'm just pointing out. Right? I don't know. Right? This is part of Malcolm's point. I don't know what Rav Moshe's right. Rav Moshe by calling it theft. So I think by calling it theft, he excludes people who charge the prices that are necessary for them to stay in business, even if those prices are exorbitant and relative to other things. I don't think he's committing himself that way, but I think that he's willing to call it theft is a big move. Okay, Chalashim Mishpat Aleph Lamed Chet. Okay, this is the tshuva that Rav Jaffer said everyone makes an enormous deal out of, and it's kind of funny because we're building a whole economic theory about shul membership. And Rav Moshe's vision of shul membership is one that probably just sort of looks weird to us, the notion that congregants sort of belong to the shul. And that the rabbi, so we have to get over, let's say, first of all, and this is really, this is an issue I will quote, Rabbi Zalman Krems is the head of the KVH. Had a cool hara to me the other day.
KVH is a Boston.
KVH is the Boston Hashgacha agency and the body of all that. But he heads the Kashrus agency, so KVH Kosher. So what he said to me was, he said, there's a controversy between the Haredi and the modern Orthodox world to some extent about women rabbis, which to some extent revolves around the question of women having positions of power, svara. And maybe the issue is that in the Haredi world, rabbis have power. And in the modern Orthodox world, rabbis are in place. And so the non-Orthodox world, the notion that you have a sorority issue in terms of, right, and this is part of it, because you don't have in the non-Orthodox world a place where the rabbi owns the shul. But the Haredi world, a perfectly normal model is that the rabbi literally owns the shul.
That's the case of my rabbi at YU.
My sister-in-law's shul for many years until they built the whole new building. That was a whole controversy. So the rabbi owned the shul. Right? And it's a wholly different relationship if the rabbi owns the shul.
And they're using their own money, they're investing their own money to buy the shul? Is that what's
they own the building. Right? They're granting the synagogue the right to daven in their building. Absurd?
Why is it absurd?
I understand
it's
that
the real way. Why is that worse than these institutions themselves on
Moshe ends up going and defending the idea that this rabbi has to make money. You're making money off of something you shouldn't be making money off of. How is that a good thing?
You're making money off renting a synagogue space.
Exactly.
Why shouldn't you be making money off that?
You're going to make money off of allowing people to do a mitzvah properly?
People do it all the time.
It's like the most basic thing. And Rav Moshe is going to tell them you can't daven in your house. You have to daven at the shul.
It's not a profit. It's not a whole profit thing.
No, this guy is living off.
Yes, this is his
thing. Same thing with minor sexuals. Also, your dues are going to the salary of the rabbi.
Those are going to the salary of the rabbi. We can also kick out the rabbi when we don't like him.
Yes, so this is right.
If you don't like the rabbi, you can stop talking at the shul.
So,
we can't. It's
we're talking about
the rabbi.
Yes.
Who needs to be supported by this.
Yes.
Dafka this.
Yeah,
rabbi.
That's his conception of a rabbi.
Although we should be careful, because he might allow individual members to slip out. They just can't do it in an organized way.
He doesn't say you have to dominate, he just says you can't set up something else.
You can all walk as far away as you want.
That's what he says in the event.
Right, but if it's not in the same neighborhood, only if it's really inconvenient.
Yes.
I'm taking issue with the conception that the rabbi has a right to make a living by this, by making a shul and giving people a space to daven. It seems deeply strange. I understand that kashrut is
a cultural
life
thing.
But is it not
odd? If you end up with this,
the way I'm looking at it is that he's charging. It's sort of like opening up yeshiva. Like, there's a rav, he wants to be Marvin's Torah, and he... Haga, he lets people
come
in his house.
Right, it's supposed to.
So the counter argument is, right, is so your rabbi will always be owned by the wealthy people. Mm-hmm. And right, and he can never tell you we don't want to hear. He's not really a leader. He's always thinking about his next contract. And so, in what sense is his psak free? Mm-hmm. Right, that's the counter argument.
Right.
No,
it's a very different model. Like, it's not we are a community that wants to pray and we'll bring in some rabbi to like answer it. There's some sort of like you actually need the rabbi. So the rabbi is not just like a figurehead.
You move somewhere because you want to daven with him.
Neither of these seem legitimate.
Okay,
okay,
good.
Suppose you have a town doctor, right? And the only reason he just providing an essential community service and helping women give birth to babies, and there's no one else to go in the town.
Right.
And then, but he's also trained his whole life.
Yeah.
So now if a third of his clients go hire a new doctor in town, or they go bring a new doctor into town, they're totally leaving his business.
Was he being a not nice person?
Did he like to call it the woman going to communist?
They didn't like him. I'm serious. But if in that situation we think of the doctor as doing a community service by having trained for all the years, right, throughout the town service,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, if you wreck his business, he has literally nowhere else to go.
Like,
he has no other, and he has
limited...
And he has non-transferable skills.
Right.
And he doesn't have any capital to relocate.
So too bad.
Right, nor before have we limited where people can shop. We've said you can't come and compete, but to tell people that they can't buy the product, which is essentially
I think a localized economy. We only have global economies.
But that's all that we're dealing with. Someone trains their entire life to be a psychologist, and then it turns out that they can't look a person in the eyes. Is it a problem that I don't go to that psychologist?
Well, we should be careful, because... You're not really, because you're talking about, if that were the case, then nobody would have come to the shul in the first place.
Yeah.
Right, so...
This person turned sour. I don't know.
So that is, right, so part of it is, right, is so the person turns sour. So part of it is the general issue, you know, what happens when people are, when people get old, but they get old young.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so what is a shul, To me, the case that brought a lot of this home to me was by David Jaffe, perhaps some of you met, is back in town again. So he was part of the, she'll try and find a time in the shows if you have a chance. So we had a whole repeated conversations about the hotel, boycotts against the Pritzker chain, because they were outsourcing their cleaning services, and you know avoiding the, I forget what the name of the hotel chain is. It happens that the Jewish Day School conference was being scheduled for one of the hotels owned by this Jewish family, and there were all the progressive Jewish organizations wanted to boycott because they were outsourcing their jobs. But here's the question: you're hired as a chambermaid when you're 20, at $7 an hour. When you're 45, you have reached the apex of your skill as a chambermaid. Are you better than a 20-year-old?
Yes.
Your experience?
Yeah. And the answer is, for all that we want to build up the experience, the ones who, you know, if you had other skills, you would be an administrator by now. You're still a chambermaid for 25 years. So all right, you're a little bit better at tucking in sheets, you can do it faster, things like that. But if you've been getting regular promotions, regular wage increases, right? So you are now making 2.5 times what a 20-year-old makes. There's no way on earth that it's economically viable to pay you 2.5 times what a 20-year-old is. So, right? So what happened to these hotel chains are that these workers, they stay for 25 years, and at some point the hotel chain wakes up and says, oh my goodness, we're paying 2.5 times what we need to for all these, right? And because they were good, so people didn't leave the jobs. Right, so often a strategy in this is to make the job unpleasant enough that nobody stays more than 4 years. So it's always an entry-level job to replace your staff. But if you're actually good to your employees, so they will stay 20, 30 years. But if you're unionized, you have an effective union. And so what happens someday is that some manager comes in and says, you know what, under the union contract, we cannot fire these people who hire 20-year-olds. All we can do is outsource the job, so we no longer have to negotiate the union. That's what happened. So the count, right, and economically, it makes no sense. It makes no sense at all to pay 45-year-olds 2.5 times what you pay 20-year-olds. The only thing is, it might say in a moral society, somebody who's been working at a job, right, is working at a job, they have a right, some people have a right to an economic career arc. And that there's something wrong with our society when somebody works for 20 years, and after 20 years they're still making the same thing, the same amount they're working at the beginning. That's not the way we want our society to run. And that's really the fundamental argument, because you can't defend, right, you know, the attempts to claim that, you know, that this is counterproductive because they're really going to lose all their employees because their chambermaids aren't as efficient as they were. That, you know, if that were the case, the market would correct. Now, it may be that was true because somehow all the other hotel chains are still unionizing and it doesn't seem like there's a huge economic advantage. But it was a plausible claim. So the same token, right? You have a rabbi. The rabbi set up a business, and it's, you know, and he never thought of it, right? It's hard for us to even start, to even begin. How did you start this way, right? How did the rabbi move in and think he was building a business, right? But we have a model like now that we do all get, which is Chabad, right? And part of Chabad's model, and the reason Chabad has an enormous advantage over other Jewish organizations, is that it sends people out to make permanent homes, and they're not transferable, right? And that's a whole different model. Right, so modern Orthodoxy has JLIC, where if you're lucky, somebody stays on campus for 4 years, right, and if they get really good, they're going to leave. We had the Sharon Cole here, which had two wonderful guys who built something, and are now both leaving. Right, so all the social capital, right, that they've gained, you know, a significant amount of it is probably going to be lost. So there are advantages to setting up a community where rabbis have things, and people know when they move to a neighborhood. Right, so that's the whole, right, so here, right, so I moved to this neighborhood in many ways because Rabbi Sender recruited me. Right, so I, you know, so my whole family moved here and I built an organization here, and Rabbi Sender is being replaced. Right, Rabbi Sender is leaving. So I have no idea what this community is going to be like. In 2 years, you looked at Kadima, you see Kadima has gone wildly back and forth over the past 10 years. So maybe it's much better to have genuine continuity in the shul, you know, assured continuity, so people know what they're getting. And the price of tenure always is that, you know, a certain amount of decline as years go on, and some people who sour in their job, and that's the price. But the question is, should rabbis have academic freedom? That's another way of framing it. Should rabbis have academic freedom?
Historically, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they get kicked out.
We had both models.
And they kick and scream.
We had both models. The rabbis tend to think that rabbis until recently in America, you know, people tended to think that rabbis should have academic freedom the same way most academics think.
And they still do. That's why it's like there's a split profession between the shul rabbi and the yeshiva rabbi. And that the yeshiva rabbi can publish as much as they want and say whatever they want, and now that we have the internet, people can see it and know what they think. And the shul rabbi is beholden to the rich people who bought the house and put his kids through school.
That's a fair point. Whether it's true, whether you're right about the yeshiva rabbi, also depends. It depends whether you're right, how you run a yeshiva. Right, you run it as a wholly owned, you know, private business. In a chinami, if you run it right. You know. You never, right, you're always going to be economically dependent unless you happen to be independently wealthy. Right, so you have a model like Herb Kohl, right, the senator from Wisconsin.
What?
That was his campaign slogan. Too rich to be bought.
The backside of it is you're rich enough that you can buy yourself your spot.
Happened in. Yeah. Happened often. Happens in England all the time. Yes, Chaim. Could be, or it could just be that he set up a shul and there were front people there and they started davening there and it got built up, and over time the community, you know, as it became more important, so the rabbi became somewhat more important. Because when you got together, well, you know, it was just a group of people davening and there's a shtiebel that grew. You've seen, right? That's a place where shtiebels grow. And as over time, as they grow, they hit critical mass, and all of a sudden, if you watch Shari Tfilin Newton, right? So Shari Tfilin Newton was a shtiebel that grew. It's interesting, right? It's a non-Orthodox shtiebel. That was, when it was originally set up, it had a three-person community of academics that functioned in lieu of the rabbi. And at some point, the shul got Alexander Altman and Marvin Fox and Nachum Sarna.
That's fascinating.
And then at some point it got too big, so they hired Marvin Simkovich because they decided they needed a rabbi. And at some point it got too big and Marvin decided he needed a real rabbi. Right? And he didn't want to be a shul rabbi of that sort, and that's why they hired Rabbi Samuels. Pardon? Yeah, right. So that's I think that's perfectly normal. Okay, we gotta go on. Okay, so there's this Rebbe, right, where there are people who have davened him from the day that he bought the shul. Now I have to figure it, right, so so it's really the shul's only been there for 3 years? Sounds like it, right? It's only 3 years. And after 3 years, they found in his boundary, whatever his boundary is, another shul.
Wait, they found or they established?
They found. They used to, right? They found, right? They found, right?
Not like
right.
Founded.
Founded, if you want. Okay, right? I was different. We have an argument about the tense. Actually, right, and by this he said,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
So Rav Moshe writes the question, and he says, right, and the question is already tells you where he's going to come out, right, he says, and by the way, they also lowered the price of his building. Because, right, he can't, right, the building is set up as a shul, and there's no market for another shul anymore, so... Right, and furthermore, Rav Moshe seems to suggest that, okay, you could try and sell it as a yeshiva, but it's not set up effectively as a yeshiva. So basically, the space in this person's building, as is only useful, is only useful as a place to daven. So, if you have a giant shul and there's no one to sit in it, then you can't sell the building for its worth. Yes.
Is Brooklyn then so different from Brooklyn now?
Yes.
Yes.
Why? Because you can always.
There are no shuls every 2 blocks or something. Like...
Yeah. So this is 1958 or whatever it is. So yes, you know, this is before Flatbush and Brooklyn have spread in Mets. Yeah, well, it may be, as we told right after yesterday, right? So we look at the Noah's Ark Mazanim case, and we say it was a win. But what happened at that point was they really, right, the Wayu Beitin really, you know, set a complete control on their menus, and every time they put a new item on, they have to go back to the Wayu Beitin and ask them, are we allowed to add condiments on our hot dogs? Are we allowed? Because the rule was you could only do it as long as you weren't serving fast food. Yes, Ellie?
I was just really confused by this case. Where is the rabbi's income coming from? Is it coming from the rent, from like the membership fees? From
I assume some combination of membership fees, mishaberachs, annual
like,
donations.
But things, that's very hard to quantify exactly what.
Yes.
Like, so, like.
But it's been enough.
What?
It's been enough.
It's been
enough. He's made enough.
It sustained him.
It sustained him. Probably it's mostly appeals and aliyos and shul.
And also, you think of you talk of tenure is irrelevant here, because here the rabbi is belligerent.
He's only
belligerent according to some number of congregants, first of all. I think the way this tshuva is set up is like really...
No, he admits to being belligerent. He straight out admits to being belligerent. He just says he has a reason for it.
Yeah, but like the thing is, that the way this tshuva is set out, it really like presses all of our like consumer protection buttons. Like we hear this as like straight up a case of where we should be protecting the consumer and not the...
Yeah, so on the other hand, you should say, right, these people started davening in his building. Why? Because his building was convenient.
Yes, this is just a totally different reality.
But part of it is also expectations. He opened up his building, and he is functioning in the universe where if you daven in, right, if you come daven in my room, right, you are now my sheep. And sometimes I have to shear you.
I think this is like if an academic institution had a PhD student, and they give them some stipend for some number of years. And then they decided, I'm sorry, we're terminating your residence here. And so it's true that we've been paying your salary, and so we can rescind that at any time. But we think of this PhD student as having, like, labored towards, like, a tenure-track position, maybe, or, like, an adjunct, right? As having, like, labored towards...
They hire
an adjunct. They hope that they're going to get a tenure track position, and we think it's kind of a travesty that we have so many adjuncts that are not tenure track, right?
But we allow it because you can't.
Well, we think.
Okay, let's hold the analogy for the moment because I think let's live in this reality before we look at the analogies.
Okay. He manages to hit like all of the things that like it's like totally we've totally reversed the economy.
Okay. Okay. Right. So. Right. So he's lowered the cost of the. Lowered the cost of the building because by setting up another shul because he really can't sell the building because it's not useful as a Beit Midrash and it would cost a lot to rehab. And if they had not set up another Beit Knesset, everybody who lived there and even people who came afterwards to live there would have davened with him. And by the way, there is another shul, but the Frum people don't like that shul. Right? There's a modern shul.
Okay.
Pardon? The first of all, Af Shiyesh Mod Beit Knesset, Aval Eino Lefi Ruach HaYireim.
That means modern.
Yeah, this is modern. This is Young Israel.
Oh, I thought it was conservative.
No, it was Young Israel.
No, it was conservative.
He wouldn't be so polite, Eino Lefi Ruach HaYireim, if it was conservative. No, this is a modern Orthodox shul. I don't know which shul it is. Just circle the map. I mean, I could guess, but what's the point?
You know where this is?
Yes, it's got to be near the Yeshiva of Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah.
No.
I know what it is. It's the Avion Jew Center.
Okay,
we don't need to go there. It's somewhere near 5th and L. And don't forget, it's 1957 or 58, so I don't know what shuls were there then. Shuls can evolve. I'm still, my father recently said to me, I don't know if, that rabbi... He's a rabbi of Young Israel. Like, are the people he wants to daven really going to be willing to daven there? Because my father thinks of Young Israel as the really modernish place that the people won't daven in. So people's change. People. So the sociological nature of institutions changes quite dramatically. Yes, Chaim.
Is he saying that shul would not have been modern? So then, there would have been two shuls, and then
the rabbi would have opened up in a position of competition, and the Rebbe couldn't have claimed everybody's going to daven with me, because he was already in competition with the other shul. The other shul could have sued him.
Right.
But here he's going to claim the Rebbe opening up. That's like a different quality of merchandise, because he's competing for a completely different type of person than goes to the other shul.
So since the Rebbe originally opened up in competition, so he obviously didn't feel...
No, the Rebbe didn't open up. Rav Moshe thinks the other...
If the Rebbe would have opened up...
In competition, then he would have no right to claim Hasagas Gevul, because he never had an exclusive.
He never had the right to open up either, maybe.
That may be, but certainly he never had an exclusive. He never had reasonable expectations, right? He set out his net, but there are lots of other nets there, and the fish can swim where they want. But here, the Rebbe's got his net.
Well, if you open up a third shul, the Rebbe will always lose some of his mitzvah.
Yeah, but I think that it's got it. You know, then we'll get into what the standard is. But I think that probably if there was a second shul already, so they're already competing. So you never had a right to say I expect these, because you don't know any individual congregant can go here or go here, right? It could be 80%. You know, you have no right. You have no expectation. You'll get half of them. Depends how good you are then. So if you're good enough to compete with one shul, you're good enough to compete with two. It's not going to divide automatically. All right, I think that's right. If you're the only shul in town, then everybody's going to come to you regardless. If you're one of two shuls, then you'll get as many people as you earn. And the same is true with three shuls. Right, your expectations change if you're the only game in town. Yes? If I'm giving shir today, okay, everyone in Sharon who wants to learn high-level Torah is going to have to come here. If it turns out at the same time I'm giving shir that somebody else is giving shir in Eitz Chaim, so then I know that the only people who will come are the people who like my shir. And if a third person opens up somewhere else, it's not going to change anything. The people who like my shir will come, the people who don't like my shir won't come. How do I know they'll get anybody from me? Maybe they'll just take away from the guy in Eitz Chaim and he'll go broke. There's no necessary impact on me because I'm only getting people, and I can only reasonably expect to get people who like my shir. So you'll tell me, no, I can also get people who don't like his shir. Right? But basically, right, my expectations are different. Okay. Ve'atel kishiyistu heim sheim anashim chashuvim holchu harbi mehireim shayu holchim esol devetek neses shiyistu heim. Right? And they're not just private people setting it up. Right? This is a major revolt, so it has a real impact on him. And they say, look, we can't daven with him because A, he messes up the nisuch, and B, he also curses people, and it's hard to deal with that. And C, there are also some people there who make fun of our Rebbe.
Who is our Rebbe?
I don't know.
What do they mean by that?
I don't know.
People making the time. The people who are leaving are making.
People are leaving,
time,
right? Suppose, right? You know,
somebody alive.
It doesn't say Zichron Levracha, right? So it could be that they are, let's say, they're Chabadniks.
Okay, something like that.
Right, and they're coming into a shul, and everyone's right, and from the Bima, right? Or there are always people making jokes about the currently late Rebbe, you know, and that they find that insulting.
Okay, I see.
Right, that can happen. That can, or let's suppose, right? You know, again, this can happen Forget if you're modern Orthodox, but if you went to YU and you walk into a shul and people keep on making jokes about the Rav, right, that can really upset you. Or if you come in, you know, if you come from the Haredi world, you daven a shul and people keep making Rav Yashiv jokes, right, that's going to upset you.
They do that even
in
Haredi shuls.
Make Rav Yashiv jokes? All right, can still upset you. Okay, so they think, therefore we have the right to split, and they claim... We didn't do anything to get people to come. All we did was set up the business, and people came. Right? We didn't distribute nuts or anything like that. Right?
Yeah.
Hey, we're some right? Yeah, that's the claim. We didn't drag. We didn't drag anybody. We didn't. Right? We didn't compete. I don't know if this is a different place, but we didn't. Right? Anybody? They're certainly not like they're not setting up in front of him, so you have to walk past them to get to his shul, and they're not advertising. All they're doing is providing people with an option, and if he can't keep his business, then why should he have a right to keep his business? Right? We're depriving people of choice. Okay, so you know, what do we do with this? I know what you do with this. You know, obviously, there's a certain amount of cluelessness. And Rav Moshe, I have to say that you know, the Ilamidus Shiva, and not knowing the reality of Ilamidus Shiva, you're just sort of, I think, like all of you, I just flipped out. Like, well, this is not the answer you expect. From the reality, although it is from the opening line of Shirali Deza Hesigu Gulov Kipchu Parnasato, so you know which side Rav Moshe is on, but it's still an astonishing thing. They had no right to do it because Shirali Deza Vadei Shaharbim Elo Shrei Holchem Eslok Kishlohi Miyadas Vekneset Acher Yelchu Vekneset Acher Shriyistu Diyesh Bezeh Yisr Mahapich Bechororah Vyorid Lumnes Chavero kimivur mechsam sofer chelik kol shemish basim yud aleph debedavrish ein makom lishneim ikir iser yored lumnos chaveros. So now who says there isn't room for both of them?
The rabbi. That's the original first
drama. Who says there isn't room for both of them? Right. Right? Because the Rebbe hasn't said his shul is closing, and his shul is closing is because they're getting all his congregants. There's only 3 years. How fast has his shul grown? Right? What are his reasonable expectations? And even though, right, so there we get to that. Even though there are still some people who daven there, right, since the minyan has shrunk to the point that it is not kidei chayav, A. And B, since the price of his building has diminished dramatically, this is certainly kipuach ha-parnasah she'asur. Okay, so Rav Moshe says there are two things here. A is, they so radically shrank his minyan that he can no longer survive on the gifts of his minyan. And B, that they have radically lowered his property value. Now,